the honorable Mr. Neil Costa.
We have to speak in the first place to thank you for indulging us while I need to rectify the record. I have a vote to you on the 23rd of July in respect of Parliament Question Number 445. I am inadvertently provided the honorable Mr. Bafila with an incorrect unemployment figure, and therefore I would like to read the answer as it should have been read at the parliamentary committee of last week as follows. Mr. Speaker, the average number of Gibraltarians registered as unemployed for the fourth quarter of 2014, the first quarter of 2015, and the second quarter of 2015 is as follows. The fourth quarter of 2014, 268. The first quarter of 2015, 282. The second quarter of 2015, 204. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Government motion. The Honourable Minister, the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. That this act approved by resolution pursuant to Section 46 of the Social Security Open Long-Term Benefit Schemes Act 1997, the making of the Social Security Open Long-Term Benefit Scheme Amendment of Benefit Order 2015. Mr. Speaker, this order seeks to amend the Social Security Open Long-Term Benefit Scheme Act 1997 by increasing the rate of old age pensions and provided benefits by 1.6% with effect from the 1st of August 2014 and which represents the annual pension increase for that year.
I now propose to the question in the terms of the motion moved by the Minister of Business and Employment. Those in favour?
Aye.
Government motion, the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunication and the GSP.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move a motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. This House notes that the former GSP government announced its intention of no longer funding Gibraltar Community Care and that it would be replaced by payments channeled to the social security system more favorable than the support provided by community care to current and future senior citizens, and that this is intended to be put into effect after the 2011 general election. We regret that today the GSP is in a position of refuse to share with the government the details of the proposals it claims to have had ready to implement, and which will have alleged would be better and more in the interest of pensioners than the existing arrangement, and condemns the leader of the opposition for withholding this information, which would otherwise allegedly have benefited senior citizens, and calls on him to correct the situation by providing a full detailed account before the general election of what the proposals for replacing community care are. Speaker, before I proceed with my motion, I want to clarify to the House what this motion is about. Given the comments by the Leader of the Opposition at question time, he asked me how I was going to fund the reduction in the net debt. I answered it was not for me to tell him how I intended to finance the policy objective, and he claimed that this is what I am asking him to do in respect of the motion before the House. Mr. Speaker, either the member has not yet read my motion last week, or he is incapable of understanding what he reads, which I would say would be fairly lethal for someone in the legal profession. The motion calls on him to do what we have been asking the GST to do since the day they announced they have an alternative to community care, which would give equivalent or greater support to current and future pensioners. From day one, all we ask is, how is this going to work as a statutory social security entitlement, and how is it better, and if it is better, we would support it. They have refused to provide this information before the 2011 general election, during the general election, after the general election, and at every budget scene. To this question, on each and every occasion, the response has been deafening silence. So I hope, on this occasion, the House and the interested parties, the 6,000 recipients of community care support, would get answers to what are legitimate questions. The Honourable Member advanced the information last week that the DSP under him now intends to abandon the policy that they have been committed to until now, and will instead retain community care as present discussion. But I'm afraid that as an answer, it is not enough. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar Community Care came into existence as an initiative of the DSLP and as a registered charity received financial support from the government. This was done in order to enable it to provide Gibraltar resident pensioners a quarterly household cost allowance in the knowledge that such a payment contributed to our senior citizens' ability to meet basic cost of living needs. The government view was, prior to 1996, and continues to be post-2011, that such a result can be best achieved by providing grants at a level such that the charity will be able to build up its reserves and be in a position to attain a level of investment income on which it can rely in the long term. This is, in effect, what we set out to do, to ensure so that if at any time the Gibraltar government has competing demands on its finances and found it difficult to provide support, the charity will still be able to do the sterling work in support of our senior citizens, which it has been doing since the day it was created. Although the then Chief Minister in 1998 stated in Parliament that the setting up of a charity was a very good idea, I regret to say that his actions belied his words. On that occasion, he said that he applauded the fact that we had taken the opportunity of revenue that was coming in from a particular activity, which enabled us to create the fund. That there was absolutely no criticism, that on the contrary, he applauded it. The only caveat was that if the source of funding were to drop and there were less funds from which to support the charity, so be it. At the time, the money from this product was £8 million a year, and other products contributed to the total £15 million being provided. I imagine, given the importance of the work of the charity in support of our senior citizens, that it would hardly have said or done anything else other than praise the initiative to set it up. However, he failed to practice what he preached and failed to honor what he promised. And there is no explanation as to why he was doing so until the DSD had been some 14 years in office. The present leader of the DSD and leader of the opposition has constantly praised the record of the previous year of the DSD government, shortly after his top rank to remove him from office in the 2003 election. That was when he first claimed to have decided to enter the election campaign then in competition with the DSLP, because I was not willing to hand the party over to him, and he believed I was content to allow the DSD to continue in government whilst I remained in opposition as the handbrake on any sovereignty deal with Spain. This, incidentally, Mr. Speaker, by implication suggested that he believed a sovereignty being restored was a possibility under the USD government, unless I was there to put a stop to it. However, shortly after coming at war third in 2003, he started his journey from fierce critic of the USD to stalwart defender. This to the extent that he took at the time of winding up his outfit and merging it with the USD, that if his move put them at risk, he would instead pull the plug on the proposed merger rather than expose them to risk. Such was his incipient love affair with the party, even at that early date. The last that has grown since to the extent that he now intends to cling to the leadership title, even if he gets slaughtered in the forthcoming election. Such an example of love at first sight, from outright opposition to selfless suppression of self-interest, is in my experience a rare event in politics. However, it bears a resemblance to a phenomenon in social psychology known as cognitive dissonance. Be that as it may, the facts are that it was only in the final term of office of the DSD, 2007 to 2011, when he was a former minister and therefore covered by collective cabinet responsibility, it is only then that the new explanation was first revealed. Therefore, the mantle of responsibility falls on him now to account for and defend the policy with which he is identified as a participant, as a minister, and with his recent statement suggested continue to be the policy to which the DSC still subscribes under him as leader of the party and leader of the opposition. At least it was so until last week, when he announced it was about to change. Even though in March 1996 the charity had assets of 53 million, of which 60 million was in cash, the policy was to continue to build up their reserves, and to this end we committed three payments of £5 million each in April, August, and November 1996. The Treasury was instructed to make the first payment in April. This did not happen, so the first effect of the change of government in May 1996 was that a grant of £5 million approved before the general election never reached the charity. The excuse of the DOC administration was that if it had been paid, they would not have asked for it to be refunded. But if it had been overlooked and not handed over to the charity, they had decided not to honor it because the charity had more than sufficient money. Not only did they not make this initial payment, but no other payments were made for any other year in the first term, by the end of which the reserves were down £3 million. In 1996-97, the charity continued to provide support to pensioners without any grants from the government by relying on its investment income, which was high enough to cover its ongoing costs and leave a small surplus, in spite of not having received the £5 million we had already committed to pay before the general election. This meant that cash reserves actually increased in this financial year in the first 10 months of the DOD government. The first time the reserve of community care went up under the DOD and the last. In 1997-98, investment income fell below running costs and the reserve went back to the level of 1996. In the budget of 1998, I raised the matter pointing out that we had been missing from the estimate from 1997 actual expenditure column was a £50 million grant from the Social Assistance Fund, that the same was true for the forecast outcome of 1997-98 and for the death estimate for 1998-99. The over-the-top characteristic response from the Chief Minister was, it is true that the honourable member made £250 million contributions to Community Care Limited. It is also true that this is not happening. But it is not happening, Mr. Speaker,
because it is not necessary. Always remember proposing to continue to pump in £15 million a year to Community Care Limited, regardless whether it needed it, to simply so that he could go outside to the piazza downstairs where he passed the old folks, seated by the kiosk, and say, I have given you another £50 million of security for the future. How long was he going to try and spin out that mountain? Well, I'm going to go through the 40 years of spinning out the mountain. Of course, what he knew then, and we did not, was that the charity was already failing to cover its running costs. In the 1999 budget, I raised the question again, pointing out that contrary to the view expressed previously, he hoped that the import duty might go down, the opposite was the case, and the government could now afford to resume making capital grants to Community Care. The government's response was that the grant had not been stopped because of lower revenue. The chief minister said, well, I am sure it is not intentional that the honorable member misquoted me. What I actually said was that the capital payments to Community Care were not being made because Community Care was currently fully funded to meet its obligations, but that the government had a commitment to increase its financial provision to Community Care to ensure that that remains so. And the government stands by that commitment. The income that Community Care is making from its present capital assets is sufficient to meet its payment out obligations. And the government is no virtue in paying up capital to meet an obligation which is presently being made. But of course, it is axiomatic that if and when that ceases to be so, the government will top up the financial provision of Community Care to ensure they can continue without eating into their capital to continue to make the annual outgoing in terms of payment to beneficiaries of the trust. Whereas the previous year's statements might have been intended to convey such a commitment, this had not been done in such explicit terms. But now there was no doubt. The government told Parliament that its position had been since 1996 that it would top up the financial provisions to Community Care so that they can continue to meet their outgoings without eating into their capital. We were told nothing less than axiomatic. Well, Mr. Speaker, never mind whether it was axiomatic, it was not even true. In 1997-98, the recurring expenditure exceeded investment income of the charity by £1 million, and cash reserves were down. In 1998-99, the moving to the red by the charity accelerated, and the deficit grew. The rounding continued in 1999-2000, reaching 2 million deficits in that year. In 2001, we learned something new. The GSD government claimed to be still committed to providing the annually recurring cost of the charity so that the reserve of 50 million costs would not need to be depleted. This was the reason given for buying from the charity £3 million nominal value of Gibraltar Road stock on the 1st of November 1999 and a further $7 million on the 1st of February 2001. They told us in Parliament that this was in order to protect Community Care from a diminution in the value of capital assets and that the government was purchasing the stock so that the capital value would remain as close as possible to the $60 million the charity started with. The message was clear. The House restored the information on cash flow projections were being produced so that the government would know exactly at any given moment what the ability of Community Care to meet the commitments were without having to resort to capital spending. They declared, this is the target. That is the criteria that the government follows on the question of when finance needs to be injected. In 2001, when this was being said in Parliament, the annual deficit hit almost £200 million
And by the end of that year, the reserve had dropped to 57 million from the 53.6 million reached in 1997. The reiteration of the commitment was as clear as the axiomatic of 1998, and I conclude. The next step to attempt to square the circle came with the rise on the reserve of the Social Security Short-Term Benefit Fund. The £5 million from social insurance contributions had been accrued over a number of years as a result of a larger share of the contribution being attributed to the short-term benefit fund rather than the long-term benefit fund. The removal of this money to put it at the disposal of the government for other expenditure was the first time that any government had attempted to do any such thing since the beginning of the social insurance system in 1954. And legislation was brought to enable the government to remove the money from the fund and use it elsewhere as the government saw fit, finishing up in the consolidated fund or in any special fund. We voted against this and criticized the government for making this move, and even more so for the transfer to the social assistance fund when it had been known for years how important it was to maintain a clear demarcation between the source of funding for social assistance and the source of funding for statutory entitlement to social insurance benefits paid for by contributors. In the 2002 budget, I said the following. There is one thing in the focus item which for us is an important issue of policy, which has not been mentioned and on which the opposition feel very strongly, and therefore there is a clear political divide in this house. The estimates show that in the financial year just ended, £5 million has been removed from the social insurance social benefit fund and paid into the social assistance fund. We are totally opposed to this decision. When the government brought an amendment to this house to provide for the money to be taken out from the social insurance fund and transferred to the consolidated fund or to another special fund, we opposed it and argued against it. Social insurance contributions are compulsory payments to a fund that receives of identified benefits. They are not taxes on income to provide general revenue. Just before polling day in the 2003 general election, the GSP was still defending the continuation of the charity with capital grants from the government. They issued a leaflet saying the GSP statement that the GSP had stopped funding the charity was completely untrue and that they had put in an extra $10 million into community care, clearly showing that they were at the time trying to control the planned rundown from the electorate, so they reversed their policy temporarily and went back to it after they were re-elected. So to put that $10 million in context, we need to understand that this was not a tax on their existing revenue of 2004. There was the unfulfilled commitment on April 1996 of the £5 million approved payment to the charity, which was retained by the GSD because the check had not been handed over to community care after it was passed. And secondly, there was a £5 million which was not coming from DOT or government taxes, but from social insurance contributions, first credited to and then removed from the social benefit fund. These were the only contributions which were grants not specifically linked to the operating cost of the charity. There was no federal funding until 2009, when the charity had totally exhausted its resources, and the government announced its intention of replacing it with a statutory system and started meeting its day-to-day operating costs in the interim. A projection made in October 2009 showed that by February 2010, the reserve would have fallen to £890,000 from the £63.5 million we left. And that by March, the charity would have been in the red with a tune to the tune of £1.9 million. pursue that progressively, increasing every month after that. The real venture, however, was the revelation by the chief minister in the 2010 New Year message that the community care support arrangement in place since 1990, a total of 20 years, 6 under the GSLP, 14 under the GSD, 14 years out of the 14 GSD years, which were funded by the grants under the GSLP, was about to be done away with. Alleging concerns about an EU challenge, of which there was no indication at the time, he said, "Whatever we may think of the merit of any such claim, it represents a ticking time bomb under our children and grandchildren in the future, for which they cannot have recourse to the UK. I am not willing to bequeath this potentially legal lethal legacy of a massive and unaffordable backdated claim to our future generation. And so this year, the government will, as I said at the time, introduce significant reforms to protect Gibraltar from this possibility. This reform will not result in financial loss to our pensioners or recipients of community care." The reference to the budget was to 2009. 6 months later, in June 2010, he reacted to my statement that he had allowed community care to run out of money, claiming that I was saying this to suggest that community care payments were in jeopardy, which he said I knew to be a complete and utter lie. Well, Mr. Speaker, it is not a lie to suggest that not having its own reserves makes community care payments more likely to be delivered by the charity than if the charity is dependent, hand to mouth, on the political will and financial capability of the government of the time, especially when it was relying on the delivery of promises from a government that said it was axiomatic that the 60 million cash reserves would not be depleted but kept in place. In saying it in 1998 and in 2001, and was now saying in the Chronicle interview the contrary. Namely, for example, on patients and community care, the complete abuse of a statement by the leader of the opposition that the government has allowed community care to run out of money. He did not say that as a matter of bookkeeping. He said that to transmit to the elderly the view that the community care payment may be in jeopardy, which he knows to be complete and utter lies. But if you have any reluctance to worry elderly people in the future, no. It has been the government policy for 15 years to run down the funds in community care so that we can make alternative and better arrangements. Does that mean that anybody's payments are in jeopardy? No. Payments for community care will start from where they always are, from the Gibraltar government budget assignment, which is not true. This is even more astonishing than what we have said in January, a policy of 15 years deliberately to bring community care reserves down to zero, which was the opposite of the commitment given in Parliament describing the opposite policy, namely to preserve the 60 million cash reserves, not to run it down. If it was a policy for 15 years, it is a policy that the honorable member defends and applauds. And even as a result of this policy to run down the fund, we see it finalized and reached in 2009, then he was already in government as a minister and shares the responsibility. A situation which I predicted in my 2009 New Year message when I said, keeping the reserves at the level we left them was one promise Mr. Caruana brought very soon after he made it. The government finances are likely to be in surplus for a foreseeable future, and no doubt, fairly soon, some of this will have to be provided on an ongoing basis to community care as its own reserves begin to run out, something which I have not been able to confirm.
So now the 15-year-old policy of rounding was complete. Was it replaced by a statutory entitlement to equivalent payment to social security and enhanced dignity for our pensioners, which was supposed to be all the process of the new system? No, Mr. Speaker. In the contribution to the 2010 budget, I raised the issue which we have failed to mention. I said, if the government has come to the conclusion that there is a risk of some pensioners claiming community care payments, as we said in the New Year message, and has not a plan and an alternative to community care which will be more advantageous to pensioners, then the sooner he does it, the better. We shall judge whether and if so, how advantageous it is in the city. If you have had something better than community care for 15 years, then it's certainly a mystery why he's not done it before. In his reply to my budget speech, he accused me of being selfish and cynical for saying that. And warned pensioners to steal a handful of votes for them. He went on, the honorable member opposite Mr. Speaker has poo-pooed, he said it, the idea of the need to reform community care. So there is no doubt about the difference between the party in government and the parties in opposition on this matter. The government rejects as irresponsible and unfit through the DSLT Liberal Alliance view that there is no need to reform community care in Gibraltar. Irresponsible and unfit when we thought it. I'd like to know what they think now that they say they're going to do it. In September 2010. Can government confirm whether it is still the intention to introduce this year significant reforms to the system of community care to protect Gibraltar from the possibility of any successful EU challenge, as it said it would do in the budget session of 2009? The answer was, it remains the government's intention to carry out this necessary and desirable reform, although it may suffer delay until next year. In my January 2011 new message, I said the following. One important issue for us this year is the future of community care, the brainchild of our party, and the backbone of the financial security of my generation and those that come after us. A year ago, we were told that the arrangement for the community care payments represented a financial time bomb, taking away under our children and grandchildren. Mr. Kassel, Ramaphosa was not willing to bequeath this potentially lethal legacy to future generations, and that it would introduce reforms in 2010 that would protect Gibraltar against this possibility, as he had promised to do in the 2009 budget. This year we found not one word in the government message. A time then taken away about which we have done nothing since June 2009. If the danger is as real as this, then it seems a great dereliction of duty not to have provided the protection he claims to have at its need. We are fully committed to the continuation of community care and are just to be convinced that it needs to be replaced by something else. In government, we would go for us so that it has its own financial reserve contrary to the DSP policy of deliberately ramming this down to zero, which was a reduction in 2011. In the 2011 budget, the two ministers said, Mr. Speaker, I have said before that the government is committed to reforming pensions and community care, among other reasons, to avoid the threat of a future legal challenge for which we could no longer hold UK responsible, and which may be a financial threat to future generations. Gibraltar is past the stage where the financial support that it gives to our elderly people needs to come to be in the form of charity. It would be much more compatible with the dignity and respect which we hold to our elderly in modern Gibraltar that the financial support be a matter of legal statutory right and not charity. Accordingly, with effect from next year, meaning 2012, community pensions will become a statutory right and will be paid in conjunction with old age pensions. Everyone will continue to receive
the tournament of the money as they do now, there will be no loser. No one will lose out or receive less. But it will be a legal right, not a matter of charity. I would like as follows. Community Care's future is another bone of contention, Mr. Speaker. The tipping tumble and the community care has been the way the government has chosen to describe the situation, not mine. If anything can be said to be designed to make pensioners worry about the future or the support they get from community care, surely it is to tell them there is a tipping tumble, not to say, as we have done, that our policy is to continue with the system. Here we have a classical example of the irresponsible and politically self-serving government put forward by the Honourable Member opposite. If the government says it is a tipping tumble in the budget of 2009 and has done nothing about it 14 years later, either it is not such a great risk as it chose to portray by his state of work, or he is failing to put in place a better system with a lower risk, which he claims to us obviously. Having been preparing for this by deliberately running down the resources of community care for 14 years. The claim that I'm accused of is that having seen no evidence of what it is, and having seen a number of changes introduced which in my judgment, if anything, increase rather than reduce the exposure to this, and which I do not think it is in anybody's interest for me to spell out. When I say I do not agree with him and that I will hold back my judgment on an alternative when I don't know what the alternative is, I am a self-assuring pensioner. This parliament is being asked by the government to vote money for community care again this year with no attempt being made to deal with the exposure to this, which is such a thing. Which is that he knows how to cure at no cost to either existing beneficiaries or future generations, which is useless not to put in place just then. Well, if there is such a huge risk, which we only have discovered after community care ran out of money in 2009, why does it not give a priority? As you say with the Honourable Member, he gives different reasons on different occasions. In January 2013, he would introduce it during the year. Towards the end of 2010, he said that was flipping and that it would happen in 2011. Well, I do not see what priority he has given the legislation unit to produce what is required in 2009 if after 18 months the legislation he says he needs to produce was simply not ready. Now it is 2 years and we still do not know exactly when this legislation will see the light of day or whether the legislation will be published before a general election. We were told in the budget last year that the danger of the tipping tumble going up was not imminent. Well, I can only say, if someone knows there is a tipping tumble, knows how to disable the bomb, knows where it's going to go up, then it is not unreasonable a conclusion to come to that that is the person who knows all these things is the person who put the tumble bomb there in the first place. I cannot for the life of me understand why he has chosen to make such statements. We can only start to encourage others to do something we would all want not to happen without being ready to immediately close the risk. Because I trust him to come clean and present his alternative when we see it so that we can decide if we can support it, when we know what it is, because our position is to reserve our judgment when we know what it's up to, he claimed last year that this meant I had poo-pooed his idea. Speaker, I can assure the Honourable Member that poo-pooing is not something that I have been taught how to do. In the area of the city where I was born and bred near Devil's Gap, it may be polite public school terminology, but in my environment we always use, shall we say, more robust language to declare or oppose something. He said last year that government is a real danger for future generations. I want to do it because it was the responsible thing to do to protect future generations without affecting their pension. Our reply is we do not see the danger. But if you do, get over it and do not waste any more time. He claims that this reply misses and fits the women election. He insists it will be done, but the ticking time bomb that only he sees is not going to explode just yet. Well, there is another ticking time bomb, I told him. The one we have to face in the coming general election, and that has a definite date by which it will go off. And it is, and we are here and there. The effect is the only one that can decide for a while longer when the cook is stopped. The most we are certain not to protect future generations after all, and yet use the risk of going to see as an election platform, which frankly I thought was going to happen. They would campaign on the new policy. Because the window of opportunity if legislation is needed to deal with this issue is fast closing. And if the danger is real, we should not delay one more day. Today he has produced a new version of his motive for wanting to get rid of feminist care. I hope it is not the right strategy. He says that the payments are charitable handouts and that they should become a legal crime. This is incredible. Nobody has ever suggested that the independent entity with charitable status that receives government funding from the process of import duty has spent 22 years dispensing charitable welfare payments to those who are too poor to look after themselves. The status of the institution of a charity is because it is not a profit-making organization. To employ, for example, that the social wage extension in 2009 introduced a deep instigation to which I referred above, which suggests that up to £5,000 per year can be given to a person with an occupational pension irrespective of his size, as well as in addition to earning £15,000 from gainful employment, to suggest that this is undignified and offensive to handle is simply unbelievable. The very risk that he has been hinting at for 2 years is the one that arises when the government elsewhere pays out statutory amounts which are not means tested, not linked to any threshold, and not linked to the payment of contributions. If he has an alternative that can preserve all the benefits of the present system that are provided by community care entities and intends to start funding the trust after December and pay directly the beneficiaries as from January, which was what the implication of what we have said, together with the social insurance pension, that is not enough to say so in a couple of paragraphs in a budget. If we assume that the money we are voting this week to allow the trust to continue until December, and that in January they will no longer have a role to play, and that the Social Security Department will be making the same payment to the same person, then it needs to produce the alternative mechanism now and not after the general election. If when we see what it is, we agree that it works, we will support it. We will support any system that is better than the one that is there. But it has better go further than simply telling us that it is. It is, because in fact the description today did not sound like a very safe system to me. I have to say that if payments to pensioners directly by the government leaves the government less exposed to challenge and makes it less risky when a third party than when a third party, a private charity, is making the payment, then, Mr. Speaker, everything the experts have been saying on the subject since 1989 has been complete nonsense. The ticking time bomb was discovered in 2009. The legislation to defuse it was not yet ready in 2011. We have not been able to complete it by 2015. For a very simple reason, Mr. Speaker. No one in the legislation unit seems to know anything about the draft legislation that was supposedly in the pipeline. And we are in no position to provide a brief since we have absolutely no idea what was planned. During the election campaign that followed, the GST refused to provide any explanation of how the replacement for community care would operate. I limited itself to say that no one would be worse off and that it would be implemented early in 2012. I was accused of being selfish when I criticized the policy of the GSD. Well, how much more selfish can you get than to claim you have already identified and designed, ready to implement in 2012 after some slippage, a system which is much better for pensioners, but you refuse to release it to the government of the day, so that the pensioners benefit from it, so that they can implement it, so that they can implement what was the policy and what you intended to do. We cannot do this without that cooperation. Because we never looked at, because we must look at our options a long time ago. And there was no way that we or the officials with expertise who were consulted could see how it could be done. Mr. Speaker, in my previous intervention since December 2011, when I asked the members opposite to share with us what this new scheme is, I have made clear that no one in the relevant department has any knowledge that there was any such scheme ready to implement in 2010. That it is not the case that there has been some slippage, and that it might have been done in 2011, and that it was not going to commence in 2012, and that it would not have happened if the deal had been returned to government. Well, if no such alternative exists, then the members opposite participated in an election campaign promising to deliver a replacement system from pensioners which would be better than community care when no such system existed and there was no intention of delivering on this election promise. What this is not explained is why they should want to do away with community care if there was nothing to put in its place. And why was it necessary to do it in 2009, other than the fact that the reserve of authority had run dry that year? But in any event, it is not as if there is any evidence that their alternative, even if it ever existed, would have cost less. Unless, of course, it was not true that everybody that is eligible now would have been eligible under the proposed statutory scheme. This is not the only issue that needs explaining. If in 2009 something happened which led the honorable members opposite to conclude there was a ticking time bomb and they had a solution which the Social Security Department was not aware of, why have they been unwilling to share it with us? So that we could have done something about the ticking time bomb since 2011. We would have been happy to look at a better option if it worked and let them take the credit for thinking of it. If the pension system no longer represents such a massive risk that merits the ticking time bomb label, what has changed in 2009? If indeed, as we stated in 2010, and as the evidence from the finances of the charity suggests, this was no sudden decision, nor was it a case of benign neglect, as I have assumed it to be, but a deliberate policy carried out systematically in 1996, then there is a lot to answer for. Given that this parliament was told the very opposite consistently throughout the 40 years, a classic example of misleading the parliament and the electorate on a massive scale in a highly sensitive and very important issue with no explanation as to why it was done and no apparent reason for doing it. I commend the motion to the House.
I now propose the question in the terms of the motion moved by the Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GSP.
Mr. Speaker, my intervention will be rather short. I hope that the Honourable Gentleman doesn't interpret this as a sign of my dismissing anything that he has to say. It's very interesting to hear what he has to say, and much of which I think had some force. So I hope that he doesn't interpret my short intervention as a sign of dismissing anything that he has said today. Mr. Speaker, I am going to use the presentation of striking at his political path in the way that he has struck at my political path. And indeed, I'm not going to strike at anybody else in the government side of their political path because I'm not the only one to have changed political parties, because really what I want to do is to concentrate on the issue at hand, which I accept is an important one. What I will say is this, Mr. Speaker. It does sadden me that somebody who has had a distinguished political trajectory and a distinguished political career the Honourable Gentleman has had, and I accept that he only seems to be caught in a political time limit. He has spent an hour of this Parliament's time, not arguing with me or debating with me, because I've already said that I agree with much of what the Honourable Gentleman has said in terms of how we structure this particular issue, especially this question, the funding of community care. He has spent an hour arguing with the Honourable Robert Bunter, former Chief Minister, who isn't even here, Mr. Speaker. Who isn't even here, because he has spent an hour with quote and counterquote about what he said, about what Mr. Kapilwani said in response. It was almost a valedictory statement of his political career and his political and personal political battle with the Honourable Robert Bunter, Sir Peter Kapilwani, which I believe are irrelevant in today's political climate and in moving forward and looking to the future in terms of trying to work out issues of this nature and trying to see how best one can fund community care and make payments to our audience. Mr. Speaker, the motion reads as follows, the second paragraph. Regret that today the GLD in opposition has refused to share with the government the details of the proposals it claims to have had ready to implement and which they have alleged will be better and more in the interest of pensioners than existing arrangements. But Mr. Speaker, I am telling you that the GLD has no alternative to the funding of community care in the way that they are funding community care now. I've told them that every political party is entitled, sometimes when there is a change of leadership or indeed a change of personnel, to change their policy. We have changed ours. Now, if he was really interested, and if I wouldn't debate it, of course, if he was, because I believe it would be damaging to the greater, public interest, and indeed to pensioners who, at the end of the day, are the ones that benefit from community care. If he was really interested in alternative to community care, because, for example, and he's already quoted the Honourable Robert Bunter in 2009 when he said about the tipping time bomb. If he was really interested, well, why was it a tipping time bomb? He could have written to me, and I could have discussed it with the Honourable Robert Bunter, and it could have been dealt with behind the secret chair. Very often the Honourable Gentleman asked me, when I asked the question, well, let's deal with it behind the secret chair, because it's a matter that it may be commercially sensitive. But there cannot be anything more sensitive, Mr. Speaker, than an allegation that community care was a ticking time bomb. And if you were to ask me, well, why is that the case? I'm quite prepared to sit down with the Honourable Robert Bunter, for the Honourable Robert Bunter to explain it to me in private, and for me to explain it to the Honourable Gentleman in private, not across the floor of this house, because what I'm not going to be doing is placing in the hands of the Spanish government or anybody across the frontier any ammunition that they could use against us and against community care, which at the end of the day is something that is in place in order to benefit our pensioners. And indeed, it's something that is the advocate for it. And it's one of the factors in his political career. And I don't suppose that he would do anything or want me to do anything across the floor of the South in order to jeopardize that community care. So that is what he's interested in. Is what he's interested in is an explanation. Why was it a ticking time bomb in 2009? Well, I will talk to the Honourable Robert Bunter, and we can have a conversation behind the Speaker's chair and talk about it. But, Mr. Speaker, as far as policy is concerned, we have absolutely no intention of changing the current structure for community care, how community care is funded, and the receipt of community care payments by all of you. Other than that, Mr. Speaker, I cannot usefully contribute to this debate.
Does any other honourable member wish to contribute to the motion? The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. You see, the Honourable Gentleman, in his contribution, the Honourable Member in his contribution,
and how suggested that the statement by the Honourable Osama in presenting this motion, sort of speech by him, somehow suggested that Osama, to use his words, is caught in an apolitical tone. Speaker, I think that that requires some careful reflection. Because the music here, which is the subject of this motion, is actually a very real and present issue for many members in our community. The charity community care pays a household cost allowance today to many people who sincerely need or genuinely need that money. And I just suggested an argument about the possibility of community care continuing to exist, not in the political league of 96-2000 or the league match 2000-2003 or even the league match 2003-2007, but in the run-up to the general election in 2011 and what might have been the policy of the current administration, where of the political colour of members opposite, is not to talk about something which is in history. It is to talk about the issues which are present and real. But the speaker, it is true that Mr. Kahwana, the Honourable the backbencher, is political history. It is true that the GSD may soon be political history, and it is true that the Honourable member obviously is doing everything possible to make himself political history as soon as possible. But Joe Osama has demonstrated today and in other interventions in this House in the past year that he's very much a part of the present and of the future, with his incisive analysis of a number of matters, in particular, now on this important subject. What we have seen, however, from members of the group is not just falling into the trap of once again seeking to portray a member on this side in terms which are less than positive, I mean, accusing the fan of being 14 and 10, etc. What we've seen, and this is a factual description, I think, given what we've just heard, is a political U-turn of the highest order. And I don't think that the Honourable Member opposite has tried to hide that. Perhaps he speaks about it to his credit. But it demonstrates, in terms of consistency, that it may not be possible to even describe members opposite in that current incarnation as the GSD. Because of the people who stand under the banner are so different, and they represent such different policies, and you think, of course, they have the right to change those policies, but are they really the GSD? I put it to you, Mr. Speaker, and to all those listening, that the answer is no. But we are seeing a transformation, not just of approach to this subject, but of many others, some of which we might actually welcome on this side of the House, that the party opposite is not actually the party that we had opposite us until the Honourable and then of the backbencher repeatedly some 24 months ago. There is an opportunity, Mr. Speaker, however, for broad agreement across the floor this afternoon. The Honourable Member has in his statement at least recognized the huge value to this community, in particular to our country, of the work that was done by the Honourable Mr. Bassano when he was Chief Minister in the establishment of the charity community care. Ably assisted, if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, by Mr. James Levy, QC at the time, who was, I think, and still is the chairman of the trustees of community care, that has been able to withstand repeated attacks from people beyond the shores of Gibraltar, not just in Spain, and have therefore demonstrated, Mr. Speaker, that the brains of Rossano and Levy together were able to devise a mechanism to protect the income of our elderly people in Gibraltar in a manner
as effective as was necessary and which was unassailable even by those who at one stage sank to an unprecedented low and described those arrangements as a scam. And Mr. Speaker, I think that given the debate in this House has been less than friendly in the past month, this is a good opportunity for the House, in considering this motion and having heard what the Honourable Member has said, which I have dealt with until now, concentrate on that issue, which I think meets a great measure of agreement between us, and that is to recognise that work that was done by Joe Bassano in what will be, in my view, one of his many very enduring legacies to this community. It is not lost on me, Mr. Speaker, and I'm sure on many others, that the photographer that took the portrait of Joe Bassano for the booklet that the Gibraltar Photographic Society issued, I think, 3 months ago, of local personality, in setting up the shot, put in view just at about the same level as the legendary mustache, the account of community care, a booklet on the account of community care, and which was as visible as all the other well-known and well-loved characteristics of the man being photographed. That, Mr. Speaker, will be his legacy, and I think the one good thing, one of his many legacies, and the one good thing to come of this debate, is a very large measure of agreement for us to draw that as a legacy.
Does any honourable member wish to complete it before I ask to move on to reply? The honourable Mr. John McKenna.
I think what the Honourable Member somewhat states simply by saying, well, look, this is history, that's the past, and let's look to the future, is that we're not talking about 2,000 years ago, we're talking about 2010. That is to say, the year before the general election, his position as part of the government had to be what the House was told. The position of the government there said, there is no doubt that the difference between the party in government and the party in the opposition is that the government rejects as irresponsible and unthought through the view that there is no need to reform community care today. Well, should I now welcome him to the ranks of the responsible and unthought through? I mean, these things are not, you know. Well, one of the things about Parliament and Hampton is that everything is like this place cuts the top of you to the right. I mean, it's not a guy like me that remembers everything over the last 43 years that got a very safe thing. So what I'm saying to the Honourable Member, independent of the issue of whether I was a rich or I wasn't a rich, because it's not a question of us by mentioning the rich doing something that is dangerous, we are saying we do not believe the rich is rich. But if you tell me that there is a risk, and you feel that it's dangerous to explain it to me here, then it's up to you to say to you, as has been said, when the Honourable Member gives the example of being asking a question, he asks a question in public, he gets the answer in private. Well, I'm asking the question in public, and I've been asking the question in public for the last 7 years, since he was first mentioned in 2009. But I've never had the answer in public, or in private, or an offer of the answer in private on the basis that the other one, it was not in the public interest to give me the answer in public. The reason why I didn't get an answer is because there was no answer. We still don't know why the GSB wanted to shut down community care. We don't know that. Because if it's true that a change of leadership can make a ticking time bomb disappear, then we discovered some new concept in life which I've never heard of before. If it is true that the Honourable Member was a member of that party when it was thought irresponsible and unthought through to say there is no need to reform it, if that was true, then he should be able to tell me without having to ask the distinguished backbencher where it is that makes us irresponsible because he's now joined the rank of the irresponsible if he doesn't know it himself. Well, I can tell the honorable member that in my judgment, the risk did not exist. In my judgment, the way that it was set, that it was going to be done, is impossible to do. And I will tell him why. Because if he goes back to May 1996, in the official opening of the House, I reveal that the British government, before the 1996 election, had tried to commit me to give a written indemnity and an undertaking that communities would be closed down after the election, rather than the election. And I refused to do it. And the first thing I did was make it public in 1996 and ask the DSB to resist the paper to close it down, which they did because it's still there. And I'm glad that they did. But having resisted the pressure, it would appear that for reasons that were never spelled out, of their own volition, they decided that there was a better way of doing it. And it would not have been a controversial thing if from the first day we didn't say, well, look, if you have got something better, we're not going to do it because if you say black, you say white. And if you say white, you say black. We didn't say that. We said it's better. Tell me how it's better. The answer is that what I brought today for the honorable member may just be repetitive history and living in a different time warp. But I have to tell you, what this record shows is consistent lying in Parliament. That's what it shows. That is serious. Because I've given the evidence. Yes, I will give it.
Because you see that. He's not making an allegation of lying to me, because of course I made none of those statements. But he's making an allegation of lying against the Honourable Debatator, and I urge on the Honourable the Speaker to show consistency in the way that this question of lying has been dealt with. And Mr. Speaker admonished me, and I said the Honourable the Chief Minister had been lying, and he made certain allegations against me, and I think that he ought to uphold the rules of the elegance of the Honourable Parliament.
The legal decision, I think, is quite right. I would urge the Honourable Mr. Bosano to withdraw what he has just said, and perhaps he might think that what was happening was that the Honourable at that time never got around to revealing what plans he had.
The thing was then about having plans, because he managed, I'm telling the Parliament, that there were no plans. At least there were no plans known to anybody around him, but he might have had plans in his head. But what I'm saying to the House is, the House was told on several occasions that the 60 million pounds will not be touched. Now, you can only use the red line in a substantive motion. And this is a substantive motion, and if I have to move an amendment to the substantive motion to include the distinguished backbencher, then I will do it. But what I cannot accept is that I have to withdraw if I am telling the House on such and such a date, we were told that it's an axiomatic commitment that the reserve will not go down, and on such and such a date, we are told the government has been planning from day one to eliminate the reserve. Well, look, the two things cannot be true.
Question of unparliamentary language, but you're right. The context is important. It is a context in which it is being said, which very often determines the extent to which it is unparliamentary. I take the view that I don't think it is entirely fair in the absence of the Honourable Patricia Caruana, why he should be accused here today of lying, when probably it is clear to you from what I have heard of the history that Mr. Bosano has outlined, it is clear that
he seems to have been the only one that felt that it was a potential time bomb, because given the principle of collective responsibility, one would have expected the Honourable Lumière Reposition to have known about what those plans were if they actually existed. I can never recall in the, during the 16 years when I was in government that the principle of collective responsibility did not apply. Other than in some cases of foreign affairs, where something went from Gibraltar to London, which history has recently shown all ministers would not know about. But on an issue such as social security, social assistance, we would all have been involved. And it is clear that the leader of the opposition, who was a member of that government, there are other members of that government here, they don't seem to have been aware as to what plans they were, neither are officials aware. So perhaps, I think it would be more correct to say, this is what the then Chief Minister had in mind, he never got around to doing it. I haven't said that it ran about the time bomb, because if there is something described as a time bomb, it's a matter of opinion and it's a matter of judgment. And something might be considered a time bomb by Mr. Caruana and not considered a time bomb by me. What I am saying is that it is not possible to say that the GSB government, because it was taken not as an individual, but in the name of the government, the GSB government gave a solemn undertaking in this parliament on several occasions that they would guarantee that the £60 million reserve would not be depleted. They gave a solemn undertaking. And when I said, well, they have not honored what they committed themselves to, they've not honored it, the answer was that I was lying. I was told the liar for saying they had not done it. But then the person that called me a liar turned around and said that I am lying because it's not that we didn't honor a commitment, it's that we never intended to comply with it because it was planning from day one to run the thing to see it. So the two statements cannot be true. So if to say that somebody is lying is something that one should not say, I would say one should not say that unless there is evidence to, and this is, if anybody makes a statement in Parliament, it should back it up with facts. And I am backing it up with facts, because it's not my word. I am talking about the policy of the government, not whether an individual person, whether it's a chief minister or a backbencher, tells the truth or doesn't tell the truth, as a person, you know, neither. 100% careful, 100% of the time. That's not the issue. I am talking about it, the credibility of a party that is going to an election this year and making electoral promises. And if I make an electoral promise, say, I'm going to put a new system in if you get me elected, and there is an extraordinary evidence that they are going to do it, well, what do you call that?
I would say that. Political credibility is not the same as telling a personal lie in Parliament. The two are different. And therefore, to that extent, if that is what he has in mind, then I think that that amounts to a withdrawal of the word lie as applicable directly to the Honourable Leader of the Opposition. To the Honourable the former Chief Minister.
Yes, but I am not doing anything. Let's be clear.
If, in order to make it consistent with the ruling, I have to move an amendment to include him in the motion, I will. Because as far as I'm concerned, it's not about him. It's about the party. It's about the party in government. The government of Gibraltar, the person that stands up for the government of Gibraltar today is my friend, Fabian, and he will stand up and say something and say, this is what the government policy is, and that government policy is saying in the name of all of us. And if it is saying it's not true, and all of us are equally guilty. This is not about a person telling a lie. This is about a government openly, deliberately, and unquestionably saying things in Parliament which are not true, not even misleading, not true, because they say there is £60 million, and I can prove
today that when they said there was 60 million pounds, there was not 60 million pounds. Because they said we are monitoring it closely, and I can prove that that government was not monitoring it closely.
And as a fact, it is a fact of political life that government, even in democracy, are very often economically to the truth. And the years go by, and then we find out that that is the case. But that is not the same as deliberately uttering a lie here in Parliament. That is not the same.
Not what Mr. Speaker, it's not what Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I would urge Mr. Speaker to be careful here, because Mr. Speaker, I think inadvertently, I have to say, is now descending into the political arena, because what he's doing, in order to try and get the Honourable, the Father of the House, out of a procedural hole, because he has a lot of assistance for him, he is now trying to give him the political out, which is the BOD government was economical with the truth. But look, you know, that's not accepted in my
I have been many instances.
I can't recall myself being in government and things being said by ministers, by the chief minister of the day, which were not 100%, which would not stand 100% investigation. Because that is politics. And it's a fact of life. So you can say somebody is politically corrupt, and it happened in the case of Mrs. Benjamin Bocino in the budget of July 2012, and that is not the same as saying somebody is corrupt. You can say here a minister is not to be trusted in a political sense, in a parliamentary sense, and it is not the same as outside in the street when this person is not to be trusted. It's not the same. That is clear. This is what I'm saying about the context in which now. The member of the Union of the Opposition wants me to name Mr. Bocino, is that what, or that I should say something further? I am trying to give him a way out because he has been here over 40 something years. I know how obstinate people in our generation can be. As we get on in life, we can be very, very obstinate. You know, and I don't want to have another unsavory incident 2 or 3 days after I thought we'd had enough recently. You know?
Mr. Speaker, nobody's asking you to hire, nobody wants an unsavory incident. I just think that Mr. Speaker has made a comment which could be misinterpreted, and I have just pointed out that it could be misinterpreted. Mr. Speaker, I really don't want to have a situation where every session of Parliament it turns into exchanges with the Speaker, turn into a central aspect of proceedings. I really don't want that to happen, Mr. Speaker. All I have said is that perhaps you've made a comment that could have possibly been misconstrued, and I was just pointing that out, Mr. Speaker. And of course, nobody wants to have these exchanges about lying. I mean, the Honourable Gentleman could just simply withdraw them. He seems determined to continue and continue. And of course, I pointed out that Rule 35.12 basically provides, even if you were to want to move an amendment, you can move an amendment, but my understanding of this is in this particular case, you've got to give notice as well, and the Honourable, the backbencher would have to be here in order to be able to defend himself. Or are we going to have a motion without notice, effectively questioning the conduct of an MP without notice, with this MP not being here?
Yeah, no, brother, excuse me.
Mr. Speaker, as leader of the House, I'm trying insofar as possible, not to be party again. I'm trying to do a bit of what you're trying to do, which is to give both parties an opportunity here to stand by what they believe. I think what Mr. Bocino is saying, without getting into the substance of it, is that when statement A is made and later statement B is made, both of those cannot be true. And it's perhaps to say that one of the statements that was made, either the first one, which was reserved to a particular race, or the second one, that there was never any intention to preserve reserves, was one of those was not true, is parliamentary language and is a way of dealing with the subject. Alternatively, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Bocino goes on to say that what he said
was actually a preamble to moving our amendment to the motion, which includes that wording, then he would be speaking in a substantive motion, which is the amended motion, and would therefore avoid being in conflict with the rules, subject, of course, to the fact that it is true that the owner of the backbencher is not here, but notice of this motion has been given for some time, and an amendment to an existing motion is an amendment that can be made without notice. However, I would invite Mr. Speaker, both Mr. Bosano and Mr. Speaker, to accept that the possibility is to say that on the occasion that those statements were made, on one of those occasions at least, one of those statements had to be untrue. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, other people can then reach the conclusion that the L word applies in English.
The question of amending the motion. I have never known in all the years when I was a member of the House that a motion was moved by the original mover during the course of his flight to the club. When he's making up his winding up speech, it's never happened. But we can check the rules and see what the rules say about amendments. And that is Rule 21, manner of debating motions and amendments thereto.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's 45 squares, and 45 squares says that's what you want to do, is you want to question the conduct. And basically, what that says is that you cannot question the conduct of a member of parliament except upon a specific substantive motion moved for that purpose. And in any amendment, and in any amendment, question to a member or remarks in debate on a motion dealing with any other subject or reference to the conduct of the person before it shall be out of order. In my reading of that, is you cannot amend a motion in order to effectively turn it in its head into a substantive motion questioning the conduct of a member. You've got to bring a separate motion. That's my reading of this. And it flows from the wording, except upon a specific substantive motion. And in any amendment, question to a member or remark in the debate on a motion dealing with any other subject, any reference to the conduct of the person shall be out of order.
Ruled in that respect when the Honourable Member didn't write an amendment I was making to a motion about him. And that is not the correct interpretation as we ruled at the time. Motions under Standing Order 20, Mr. Speaker, are said to be possible to be amended by way. A motion which is taken with my notice is a motion which is being amended when it's being debated in the Parliament. There's no statement as to when, in the course of that debate, of the motion, the amendment can be brought. I think that is not something that is provided for, and therefore it must be proper to allow the amendment at this stage as well. In any event, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member has not yet heard the proposed amendment. He's gone on about it not being possible to call into question the conduct of a particular member. But a motion, Mr. Speaker, could be amended, to call into question the conduct of the DSC government, for example, Mr. Speaker, which is not to call into question the conduct of a specific member, or in particular, given what we're hearing about collective responsibility between individually one member in the DSC government at any particular time. But the rules, Mr. Speaker, do not prevent such an amendment being moved at the stage. And I think if I can call Mr. Speaker's attention to the type of debate which is left at the moment, and when the House is trying to agree something, often amendments are made, even when the mover is replying, to try and get to the motion that the whole House can support. In that sort of attempt to work together and have a motion that is supported unanimously, I've seen amendments moved during the course of the reply. This is in a more combative procedure, but there's nothing in the rules that prevents that.
In over 20 years membership in this House, I can never recall an instance where an amendment was moved by the mover, even exercising his right to reply, and I remain to be convinced, and I am not, after a cursory glance at the rules, I remain to be convinced that that is within the rules. Because I've never seen it happen.
Can I ask you in this respect, in the context of the ruling, to point to any part of the rules that prevent it? because if the rules do not prevent it, then the Speaker will be in a territory where simply recollection is not precedent.
Let it demand that once the mover is exercising his right to reply, that is going to be the end of the debate. And now he raises, he himself brings up an amendment to his motion when all the other members have spoken beforehand about, and now they no longer have an opportunity.
You would be absolutely right about the situation. But there is, of course, the right of every member now to speak on the amendment. So once the amendment is moved, it is requisite, we then go immediately on to vote to the substantive motion as amended. We then go on to a debate on the amendment, and therefore members will be able to speak on the amendment if they so wish.
I think I would have to take advice, I would have to consult first to May, or maybe even the office of the clerk in the House of Commons before allowing that to say. But I think that it is a pity that we were making progress this afternoon in what was a very sober, interesting debate, and the matter is turned on its head because of an unfortunate work. I'm trying to avoid that this should happen in Parliament, but I don't seem to have been of late born under the lucky star.
I'm the first to think that you're absolutely right in trying to attempt to this place, and the first person to stand on behalf of all of us here to say that we should reflect on the statement that you made last time. But a parliament is a place to party and to debate, and debate sometimes requires disagreement, and disagreement must sometimes be robust. And robust disagreement, when it is based on the sort of debate that we heard Mr. Bassano present, should not be something that scares any of us, nor indeed the public. And this is not a debate that is being conducted in any way that is anything other than entirely proper. And the only issue is whether one word has been used in this debate, if it's appropriate or not. And Mr. Bassano's position is, as I think he has explained more than adequately himself, that in the circumstances, he thinks it is appropriate and wishes to use the parliamentary devices that are available to him in order to be able to deploy that word. And Mr. Speaker thinks that despite that, the procedure which is being put to him should be followed so that the House can not allow Mr. Bassano to use that language, but debate the use by Mr. Bassano of that language, because then the House would be able to consider that. But that isn't just a matter for Mr. Speaker, and Mr. Speaker knows that on this side of the House, we accept his rulings when we agree with them, and we accept his rulings in particular when we don't agree with them, because that is what accepting the right of the referee must be about. So, Mr. Speaker, the matter is entirely not for you, but I would ask Mr. Speaker that you have raised an issue which I have never heard raised in this House. I think it will be possible to point to a number of motions which have been amended during the course of the drive, whether in combative or non-combative motions, and that Mr. Speaker must rule on that subject, because I think it's severely circumspect the ability to debate if we do not have a ruling from Mr. Speaker on this. Not today necessarily, because Mr. Speaker has indicated he will want to take advice not available immediately, but I think it is important for the House that we should have a ruling on that subject.
I wasn't here, of course, between 1992 and 2012. It may well have happened within those 20 years. I may well be wrong, it may well have happened during those 20 years, and I'm not aware that it did, and therefore it is something that can be looked into, that can be checked.
This is actually, I'm just shown by Mr. Dr. Lafayette and Mr. Preston, that the answer actually lies in 21.3. And 21.3 is actually explicit, Mr. Speaker. It says only amendment to the motion which a member wishes to propose in accordance to the provisions of Standing Orders 23 and 24, which deals with amendments and amendments in writing. So any amendment to the motion which a member wishes to propose in accordance with the provisions of Standing Orders 23 may be moved at any time, specific wording, after the question upon the motion has been proposed by the Speaker, and these are the words that I think deal with Mr. Speaker's point, before it has been put by the Speaker at the conclusion of the debate upon the motion. The conclusion of the debate upon the motion has not yet been reached. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, Section or Standing Order 21.3 engages, and Mr. Bassano is able to move the amendment.
24 says any amendment may speaker to be put into writing by the mover and delivered to the clerk.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and we have a draft of the writing ready for the clerk to pick up.
Speaker, this is the point that I have attempted to consistently make in relation to this, because in relation to other types of motions, I've been concerned about the practice of substituting effectively an entire new motion for a new one without notice that catches people by surprise. And the way the rules are structured, in my view, always gives the speaker an element of discretion, the residual discretion to say, fine, I've got the written amendment, but I require that you give notice. Now, when one is dealing effectively with a substantive motion, I haven't read what it was, and I can only go by what the Honourable the Father of the House said his intent was going to be, which was that there was going to be a substantive motion effectively calling into question the conduct of the Honourable the backbench. That was the position at that point. But of course, I take it from him without making any point of order. The issue, Mr. Speaker, is that on this question of notice and whether it requires notice and whether Mr. Speaker wants in the first instance to say, no, hang on a minute, I don't want to deal with this on the booth for X, Y, and Z reason. That particular rule in standing orders actually gives Mr. Speaker the discretion to say, not just writing, Mr. Speaker, because it can't be just a question of writing it, so I just write the amendment out and that's the end of the matter. It's also about notice, because the writing is there to give notice to those that obviously have to debate this matter. So the speaker is absolutely right that the speaker does have a discretion in relation to this, but at the end of the day, it's the speaker's decision as to whether, and I really don't want to waste any more time in relation to this, because it appears to me that the other motion in relation to LNG is something that we ought to be debating, and something that is going to be thoroughly interesting to say the least.
I think it's clear from what has emerged during the debate this afternoon, given what the Honourable Mr. Rosano has said, and what the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has said, that perhaps it is not appropriate that it is the GSC in opposition that should be condemned for having refused information, and it is not appropriate that it is the person leader of the opposition who should be condemned for withholding information, which he doesn't have, which we have been told he doesn't have, and which nobody in any government department seems to have.
Mr. Speaker, say, with the very great respect, and summoning all of the collective respect that there is in this House for you, Mr. Speaker, you have to be careful not to descend into the arena. And Mr. Speaker, you have to be very careful not to form part of the debate of GSC or not GSC. And Speaker, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has said that there is, in the rules, there is a simple discretion for you to require notice to be given. Mr. Speaker, the rules are explicit. There is no issue of discretion and notice. This is a motion that can be amended without notice. This motion has been on the order paper for a month or for 3 weeks. This motion was to be debated today, Mr. Speaker, at the earliest. If a motion is to be debated, then the possibility of amendments could arise, including, as you ruled last time, Mr. Speaker, the amendment of every word after this House, or even the word of this House, to the very end. That has been the practice of this House for the 50 years that it has had its incarnation since it was a House of Assembly. There is an amendment before the Chair, Mr. Speaker, and an amendment is within the rules. There's no provision for notice. And the House needs to get on and deal with this on the basis of the way it is done in its history and in accordance with its rules, Mr. Speaker.
Rule 20, motions not requiring notice. Unless the standing orders otherwise are read, notice shall be given of any motion which it is proposed to make with the exception of the following. A. A motion by way of amendment to another motion being debated in the Parliament. That applies here. We are now debating another motion in Parliament, and therefore an amendment can be made to it. As I said, I have never experienced that it is made by at such a late stage, but I do recall the Honourable Chief Minister recently doing something similar in one case. And I remember I put it in my mind, and I was told this has become the practice. It must have become the practice during the time that I've been away from this house. So, on that basis, it would seem that the Honourable Mr. Bofano can move such an amendment. Have you ever been circulated? Well, members of the opposition have an amendment? No, I do. In allowing the amendment, I also have to rule that an amendment to the amendment will also be allowed. I will also allow any member to move an amendment to the amendment. Now, would the Honourable Mr. Bofano then actually propose the amendment? Well, as I indicated in my previous intervention, while you were considering the matter, Mr. Speaker, the amendment to which I referred and which we now propose to move, I make it clear that the issue is not about whether there was or there wasn't an alternative in place, because I accept that I have found no evidence of it. Members of it may not have known any details about it. It was mentioned, and it's possible that the person that mentioned it didn't share whether he had his mind with anybody else. And I don't think that constitutes any evidence of something being said that was not true, because in fact, if one person doesn't share information with anybody else, well, then nobody can know whether it's true or not. But there is something which is, what I try to draw a distinction, there is something which is incontrovertible. And that is, was the commitment that was given in Parliament on behalf of the government, by whoever spoke, it's not the individual, nobody there can
nobody that was in the government can say, well, I didn't know that our policy was that we would let community care carrying on paying. The GSD, Mrs. Speaker, took the credit for all the money that was paid to the pensioners for the 15 years they were there. As if they were giving money to the charity. And they were saying in Parliament that they were committed to making sure that the reserves were not passed. And therefore, the amendment which I wish to move to the original motion is to add at the end the following words. And therefore consider that the GSD government was therefore lying in its statement suggesting it was preserving the reserve of community care for 60 million when in fact it later confirmed that it had been planning to grow down those reserves to zero from day one. The confirmation has not come from the GSLT, the confirmation has come because there is documentary evidence that shows that on a certain day it was revealed that contrary to what I had supposed, contrary to what I had supposed, I had actually given the GSLT the benefit of the doubt, and I had actually assumed that they had taken a view in 2009, and that is reflected in my original statement, they had taken a view in 2009 that maybe something different should be done with community care, because at that point, that the charity ran out of money. When I made that public, the answer that was given was, no, it was not by accident. It was not a question of not having given it the money, but it was that it was always planned from day one that the point would be reached when the 60 million pounds would run out, and then instead of continuing with the existing system, we would put something better in its place. Whether that something better was there, or whether it wasn't there, whether they intended to do it or they didn't intend to do it, the statement that there was a deliberate rundown can be tested against what happened. And what happened was, in fact, that there was a rundown. It's not that the charity went up and down on different years, which might have been the case that the government had, you know, a very good year with a big surplus, which is what we are saying now. We are saying, well, look, if the surplus is very big, we'll give more money. And if there is less money at the end of the year, we'll give less money. But what we will do is, we will give the charity the money, depending on how much money we have to spare after our recurring expenditure has to be made. Now, if the position is, on a number of occasions, the government of Gibraltar gives a solemn commitment in this house, saying, beyond doubt, it's not possible to interpret it in any other way, because it's repeated more and more. Look, we're doing all sorts of things. We're even buying their investments from them to make sure that that 50 million couldn't come. And that's a solemn promise. We're not going to give money when they don't need it. But they will never have to dip into the reserve. And they're saying that, and what they're saying is one thing, and what they're doing is another thing, then there is only one way of determining it. It may be unparliamentary. Well, look, it's not a nice thing to say of any organization or any institution. But in fact, when in the House of Commons, people are not to be telling the truth in Parliament, they are held to account for not telling the truth. It seems that somehow here it's considered risk of an evil to say somebody's not telling the truth than to actually not tell the truth. Well, look, not telling the truth in Parliament is serious, because if government, if we come here, look, my honourable colleague inadvertently gave the wrong information in the House, and he just came today to put it right. Why? Because otherwise, it could be said he had been lying in giving unemployment figures that were not correct. And therefore, when you say something and it turns out that you have got it wrong, you come back and you put it right and you put the record straight. But of course, if I have been able to demonstrate that on the very day that they were saying we are preserving the 50 million, the 50 million was already there. It was already raised 50 million. Way back in 1999, it was already 57 million. And therefore, The only conclusion is that this is not an issue about an individual, and this is not a sense emotion about an individual who is not here. This is about the conduct of a government in parliament in not telling the parliament the truth of what it was they were doing and revealing it 13 years after the event and saying this is what we were doing throughout. And in fact, the evidence that we now have showing that in fact it was true that this is what they were doing. So what they were doing was one thing, or what they were saying is another. And therefore they were lying in parliament, and I move that the amendment be supported so that we tell the truth this time. And that the truth was really happening.
Given that the Honourable Member has said that he's prepared to give the argument of yes to the government the benefit of the doubt, he might be equally generous and believe the word lying and substitute for it some other words that it was therefore incorrect in its statement or was therefore not accurate in its statement. I would not propose this question with the word lying.
I am ruling that it is unparliamentary.
Really?
I am ruling
when
it is unparliamentary, I will not propose the question with the word lying. I require that it be amended by a word that is parliamentary, such as accurate, incorrect, something to that effect, because, and then I am being consistent in doing my job as speaker, which I have a right to do, as I have told honourable members previously. If a member comes here and gives an incorrect number, then that member is giving incorrect information. If a member comes here and says something that is not true, knowing that it is not true, then I don't know what you call it and why you think to say it is a sense of justice in that the member is not here to defend himself. But Mr. Speaker, the amendment doesn't mention a member. I am saying the government of Gibraltar was not telling the truth in parliament. Meaning that word is unparliamentary. And if he doesn't withdraw it, I will suspend the session.
Well, Mr. Speaker, then are you saying that I cannot say they were not telling the truth?
You can use some of the words that are more important than the word in parliament. I will not have the word lying in a substantive motion of this parliament over which. On the question over which I am presiding. I am just not having it.
Are you saying, Mr. Speaker, that there is now a new rule that I cannot give notice and bring a new motion, but so
I am saying that the word lying is unparliamentary and I will not allow it in a substantive motion before the parliament over which I am presiding? If he doesn't want to accept that, the government can bring a motion, the government can bring a motion against me. And I will then go home, and that is the end of the matter.
Well, yes, I'm able to do that, but that's not the issue.
Go ahead and do it.
Mr. Speaker, I am not saying that I'm going to do it. I am saying I'm not going to do it. But wanting to do that, doing it, that's the
difference. I'm not going to go home, but that I may go home.
Right. What I'm asking, Mr. Speaker, for clarification on your ruling,
is that you're saying that under no circumstances, a motion can be brought to the House which includes the word lying. Is that right?
Not quite.
I am the Speaker of this Parliament.
Okay.
Then, Mr. Speaker, are you satisfied with the word not telling the truth?
No.
I am satisfied with, therefore, not correct in its statement, was not accurate, but not telling the truth, and I am the same as lying.
Deliberately misleading.
No.
Is the freedom of speech in this parliament is better than the limit, Mr. Speaker?
It is to tell you whether members are right to come out by the rules.
Yes.
And then I have to interpret, and I have to interpret the rules. People don't like it. I am getting anonymous letters accusing me. It's a fact of life. Then they're not like it.
But freedom of speech is one thing, but there is a law and there are rules, surely.
My job is to implement the rules, and it is a well laid down fact of life that the word lying is not acceptable. It is unparliamentary. It is unparliamentary when you're in a speech, even much more so, it is unparliamentary when content is an answer.
Mr. Speaker, I think that we need to reflect on the rules to understand what they're there for and what has been built up over centuries as parliamentary debating
procedure. And the procedure, which I do not have to hand, but is well known to every parliamentarian, is that you cannot use the word lie or say that somebody is lying other than in a substantive motion. Now, because this is a substantive motion, and therefore it is with the very greatest of respect that the government needs to consider your ruling, not for our sake and for today, but for the sake of the Parliament and the rights of all members on both sides of the House at any stage to avail themselves of the rules that have been established over centuries, not just in this place but in other parliaments, which we take guidance from. Because I think we have to preserve, and I have to preserve not just for the government, but for all members, the right to use language which is otherwise unparliamentary in a motion, which is what makes it parliamentary, because the rule has always been you cannot say that somebody is lying or that there is a lie other than in a substantive motion. Now, the Speaker, trying to avoid all of us who have such a high regard for each other finding ourselves in conflict, can I propose, Mr. Speaker?
I propose that I be shown evidence of the fact that the red line can be used because it is being used in other parliaments. I have never seen that happen.
All right.
And because I do not know that that is the practice, I cannot but rule the way that I am ruling.
Given
that I am being required here and now to make rulings, it's not a question of going away and coming in 4 or 5 days time when one has had an opportunity to try to find out what the position is.
Mr. Speaker, you are among the most experienced speakers that this Parliament has had, not by dint of your period as Speaker, but by dint of your service to the community as a member of this House. And if you haven't come across that principle, I will of course make it available to you in the context of dealing with this issue, not for today, but for the future, because it is very important that there should not be a ruling on the books of this House, which somehow curtails the rights of members of this House to express themselves in a way that members of other similar houses are able to express themselves on substantive motion. But can I propose, Mr. Speaker, in an attempt to ensure that old parliamentary colleagues such as you and Mr. Bassano, for whom I have proposed of equally high regard, do not find yourself at loggerheads any longer, that we'll be set for 5 minutes and that we have an opportunity of considering the language of the motion in a way that might enable us all to feel that we have achieved what we introspectively have to achieve and what the taxpayer expects from all of us, and that the House now is set for 5 minutes.
I would have better this day and have a cup of coffee.
The Honourable Mr. Gautam? I believe Mr. Gautam is an opportunity to reflect that the recent allowed an opportunity for the government to consider the amendment, to consider the issue with you. I'm delighted that there is now a bit of white smoke, if I can call it that, with respect to the amendment. I think that there is such imperfection to figure between the members of this House, but in particular, you and Mr. Bassano, who are the same age and have stayed here for so long. But I do worry that one day, perhaps even the opposition now might feel so deeply, so affectionately for each other 40 years from now. But it's very sad of people to see that we've been able to prevail.
Because the amendment that I am moving has been redrafted, so that it now reads, and therefore considers that the GSA government was deliberately providing incorrect information in its statement, suggesting it was preserving the reserve of community care at 60 million, when in fact it later confirmed that it had been planning to run down the same reserve to zero from day one. Speaker, the evidence in support is in my original opening statement, which, as I explained when I opened on this motion,
shows that there was a consequential decline from 1907 onwards, that is to say the reserves went up actually in 1997, simply because the investment income was high enough to cover the benefits paid to entitled persons, and there was money left over. But since no money was put in the first term, by the end of the first term, it was already lower than it was in 1996. And it's impossible for the government not to have known this, given that they made a statement at a later date in 2001 that they were closely monitoring the situation to make sure that what was actually happening did not happen. They were telling us, they were taking effective preventive measures, redeeming the debt that was held by the charity, which was in fact quoted in the London Stock Exchange. It was devoted government debt that was trading in London above its par value, and the government was buying that debt from the charity at the rate that it was selling in the market, so that it would not be redeemed on the maturity day where the value would have been left. And it was saying to us in Parliament, this is being done in furtherance of a policy that they would not need to take the 60 million. That information was not correct. They were buying those things, but it wasn't so that the reserves would be kept intact. It was simply because they were in effect doing the very opposite. It was because the assets were being sold in order to pay the benefits, in order to pay the cost. And it was only in 2003 that anything happened that was different, and then immediately after 2004, the decline continued. And it was only when the reserve reached zero, which was in February 2010, that we had the government openly explaining that, contrary to what I had believed, that this had not happened as a deliberate policy, it was a deliberate policy, and that the deliberate policy that the House was told was being followed was not true. It was incorrect information we were given, and therefore we believe that it is opportune to reflect this in the motion in a way which is consistent with the rules of the Parliament. I commend the amendment.
And I propose the amendment in the terms moved by the Honourable Mr. O'Connell, and of course all Honourable members are able to contribute, are able to speak about the amendment. If no one wishes to do so, I will put the amendment. That the following words be added as the last paragraph of the motion as follows. And therefore consider that the GST government was deliberately providing incorrect information in its statement suggesting it was preserving the reserves of community care at £60 million when in fact later confirmed that it had been planning to run down those savings reserves to zero from day one. All in favour? Against? The amendment is carried. I will now put the motion as amended to the vote. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House be now adjourned to Thursday at 11 a.m.
And I propose that the House is now adjourned to Thursday at 11 a.m. I now put the question that the House to now adjourn to Thursday at 11 a.m. Those in favour? And carry the House to adjourn to Thursday at 11 in the morning.